This week on Vitamin Geek Podcast, we're talking about found footage horror with Richard Yule from the Nerdy Laser Podcast and Jed Bryan, the filmmaker behind Unlisted Owner. Stick around.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
You're listening to Vitamin Geek.
Vitamin Geek.
Vitamin Geek.
Vitamin Geek.
You are totally listening to Vitamin Geek.
You are listening to Vitamin Geek.
You're listening to Vitamin Geek.
Vitamin Geek Podcast.
What the hell's the name of the show again? Vitamin Geek. Vitamin
Geek. Hello, everybody, and welcome back for another edition of the Vitamin Geek Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Keelan, and with me this evening, we have two special guests. Our good buddy Richard Yule from the Nerdy Laser Podcast. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Corey. Thanks for having me back and asking me to be on tonight.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. And I did get the last name right this time, right?
That's right.
Yes. I learned. and also, we are going to be interviewing independent horror filmmaker Jed Bryan here. He has a found footage horror film called Unlisted Owner that you guys can check out on Amazon Prime. If you have Prime, check it out. It's there. It's been in the, top 10 horror films on the...
Yeah, on Amazon. Yep, we have on whenever it was released, we made the top 10 on Amazon for Hot New Horror Release, and we stayed in the top 100 for, I think it was like 13 or 14 weeks. So it was a pretty cool run. So, but yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for being here. And that film came out in 2017, so we're a little late to the party, but you know, better late than never.
It's still going. We're actually, we don't have an official release date yet, but we actually are going to be having a Blu-ray release coming out, and it's going to have, 20 minutes of never before behind the scenes and, some outtakes and stuff, footage. And also there's going to be a, writer, director, of commentary with myself. I wrote, direct, and I also act in the film. And then Tyler Landers, who co-wrote the film and also acted in it with me. And we're being interviewed by Stephen Gillespie of Possessed Radio. He was kind of like our moderator throughout the whole commentary. So it was a lot of fun doing the commentary, and especially getting all the special features together and stuff for it. So we're pretty excited for it to come out.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, special features. Like, I'm a big physical media guy.
Yeah.
I get a lot of stuff from Vinegar Syndrome and Severin and, you know, Arrow Video, stuff like that. And I'm always sold on the special features. I mean, I want to watch the movie, but if I have time, I want to see all this under the surface stuff. That's where the real interesting things are for me, you know.
Oh yeah, all the movie magic. Like, a lot of people don't realize in Unlisted Owner that we actually built a set of, because there's a scene in the film that involves an attic space, and the house didn't have an attic space, so we actually had a room built to the specs of the room in the house to be able to get this attic space scene complete for the movie. So,
wow,
that's cool. A little bit of movie magic, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, how long did that take you guys?
The you mean filming the whole movie or just that scene in particular? Yeah,
well, putting that set together.
I actually hired a couple of a private contractor that lives here locally, Tom Dole Construction, and I took him to the house that we shot in and told him, you know, kind of what I was wanting, and I needed it strong enough to be able to fit three people up on top. And we just, I think, in probably like a week, they built the pole barn, and then to be able to get the actual cadence of the attic space of Tyler getting like jerked up inside of it. I think it took like 30 takes, and it was like all timing. I basically had a cell phone that had a video recording, because how we ended up shooting it was we went into the house and we went through the whole cadence. And when I bring the camera up, there was no attic space there. My actors had to react to nothing pretty much. And then we did some cuts and edits in there. And so whenever we had the whole film edited, and it was like one of the last things we did for the film up to that point was to build this set. And then I had to watch the camera. I had the my camera ready. All right, I had to watch the cell phone, have my camera ready and my headset on, so I could get the cadence and timing perfect with how the camera panned up. So whenever we put it in the editor, we could splice them together. I think there's like 6 or 7 edits there within like a 15-second period, I think. So it's like you're in the room, you're out of the room, you're in the room, you're out of the room, and then you're back out of the room again. And it's just like back and forth. But it blends so smooth that I haven't had anybody notice the difference yet. So, and that's what you want as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I don't think I didn't notice that.
No, I definitely didn't notice it.
and the same way with the blood in the ceiling, that was all done in that fake room as well. That was not in the house. We couldn't do that. We couldn't do the ceiling scene in the house like that either with the blood. So,
and just to give you guys a kind of a brief synopsis of the film, if you haven't seen it already, which you can pause this and go check it out on Amazon Prime, like I said. Basically, the story of a group of friends that are going on kind of like a camping trip. There's this house where some heinous murders went down, and of course they end up going to this house because it's a horror movie, guys. You gotta have some horror.
You gotta make some bad decisions if you want to be in a horror movie.
Why are y'all going in the house? Stop it. I remember somebody screaming at Freddy versus Jason when I was in the theater. Run away! Like, yeah, okay. Yeah, she's going to run right into Jason as she runs away from Freddy. Oh, there it is.
Yep.
So, let's see. The film comes in 74 minutes. Just a tight, you know, a time frame for a film. You know, you got all these movies that really, I think a lot of people shoot for the 90-minute mark. Right. And then some people overstay their welcome and hit the 2-hour mark, but 74 minutes is pretty tight. Did you find that you could get all of the storytelling done in that kind of time frame? Or,
well, I'll actually be honest with you. Whenever we did the original script, because this was the first feature we ever shot before this film, the only things we'd ever done was I did a trailer for a script I had written called Meth House. It's a teaser trailer. It'll actually be a bonus trailer on the Blu-ray that's coming out. And you can also find the trailer on YouTube. So that was the first thing we ever shot. And it was only, I think it's like a minute 30 maybe trailer. And then the other thing we did was we did a 30-second GoDaddy commercial, and we got 8 out of like 539 videos in the GoDaddy commercial contest back in 2009 or 10, I think. So, before that, those were the only two things we had shot. And I wanted to make a feature film. I didn't know exactly how long scripts needed to be able to make it feature length. So me and my buddy, we wrote this script. And after we shot everything, we thought we were pretty well set, and we put it in the editor, and it was only 50 minutes. And I went, oh man. So I had put a scene in there, road trip if needed. So we shot this road trip scene of where the drunken idiots kind of take the group of friends on a, you know, kind of a twisty turvy road and going to a cemetery and stuff. So that was kind of added in to kind of give it a little bit more length. And we also added the original Family of Five beginning sequence, which I really think helped set the tone for the whole movie. So those were kind of added after, but yeah. So it wasn't really just trying to fit it in that time frame. As more as like trying to stretch it out to be able to get it over the hour mark, and we ended up getting an hour 15. So,
what was the hardest scene in the movie to shoot?
Man, let me try to think about that. I would say the one we had the most. It wasn't really the hardest one to shoot. As far as I would say, probably the hardest one to like actually physically like on the actor would have been the attic space scene, because we did 30 takes of him going up and down, up and down. But yeah. the scene that kind of almost screwed us was where we go to the cemetery, which is a very simple scene. So we pull up to the cemetery, and throughout the film, I talked about how we do these blend edits like we did in the attic space scene. But basically, there are some scenes like the road trip scenes, like it's like a seamless scene that goes on for a long period of time. But within that, there's like probably like 5 or 6 edits that you don't see. And what I would do is at certain times I would drop the camera down We'd be doing a scene. I drop the camera. We go a little bit into the next scene. I would cut. Then we, after I was pleased with how that scene was going, we would go into the second scene. And what we would do is I would do that same drop, and then we'd continue into that second scene. So it looks like one fluid motion. So whenever we get to the cemetery and I leave the vehicle, I didn't realize this till we put it in the editor, but when we were watching it, I noticed we could see the edit from when I was in the vehicle to when I exited the vehicle. And I was like, something's not right. And I kept playing it back and back. And I was talking to my assistant director, Brent, and he goes, yeah, I don't know what it is. And I realized something, that Gavin takes the keys out of the vehicle. And then all of a sudden, so I'm in the vehicle and there's no vehicle running. And then when we exit the vehicle is magically running. It didn't start up or anything. And I was sitting there thinking back, how'd this happen? And I realized my actors who were in the vehicle complained they were cold. And I just was, you know, a lot going on. I just told them, okay, just start the vehicle up and just leave the lights off. And I didn't even realize. So it took me like 3 months to get Gavin and Tyler back around to be able to film the scene without that droning noise in the background, because on a found footage film, you don't have someone with a boom mic running around. Pretty much everything, all the audio in the film is recorded on the camera, so you couldn't, you know, it was going to be too big of a mistake for me to keep in there. So we had to go back and reshoot that. So that was probably the most difficult one for me to fix anyways.
That's wild. So what time of year were you guys shooting this?
We shot to begin with, we shot from, I think we started in September, finished up in November. Then that winter, we edited the film, realized it was only 50 minutes, then wrote the road trip scene. Then I think in July, August, we filmed the road trip scene. Then we realized we messed up a scene in that. So then we had to film the makeup scene back in October, got it done. Then we ended up showing the film the following year at Vincent's Indiana. It was kind of a focus group showing thing. And then we ended up, we had passed out surveys and people said they wanted to know more about the family of five that was killed. And that was the number one question. Number two question were how hot were Gavin and Tyler's girls? So I'm like, well, I got to appease one of the questions. So we just went ahead and went with the first one, and we reshot the beginning sequence. And then that was pretty much the wrap on the film there. So it took us a little bit to, you know, work out all the kinks, but, you know, for a first film and, you know, shooting it with just your friends and people here local, because we live in a small town, it's no major cities close to us. The closest mall to us is an hour and a half away. So, you know, you're just using local resources that you have at your hand. So, you know, just kind of going through the school of hard knocks of how to, you know, make a film. And, you know, we ended up with Unlisted Owner.
How hard was it to get the police car?
Very easy, believe it or not. A lot of people ask me this question, and I'm actually a volunteer firefighter. And so that's how we had the fire there. And then the ambulance, I mean, I just went and asked them if they'd come over and, you know, shoot the scene. And then the police officer is our chief of police. So I asked him and he said, yeah, sure, well, I'll do it. And then my mom was friends with the coroner, so we got a body bag. So, I mean, it was just, you know,
nice.
Yeah. So it worked out great. I mean, if you would have taken that same scene and put it in somewhere like Los Angeles or Chicago or, you know, some bigger metropolitan city, I mean, that scene would have probably cost you, you know, like maybe like $20,000 maybe to be able to have all the equipment and the vehicles and everything else. So, I mean, it worked out, you know, didn't cost us anything to really shoot that scene. So it was great.
See, networking matters.
Yes,
no matter what you do, make friends.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt to ask. I mean, the worst thing that anyone's going to tell you is no. So, I mean, if you need a police car for a scene, instead of having to go out and try to find one to rent or, you know, find an actor who looks like a cop, I mean, if you're – especially in your local community, just ask somebody, you know, go and ask, say, hey, you know, do you mind if we do this, you know, this scene for this film? If, you know, they would mind, you know, volunteering their time or whatever, and, you know, just see what happens. And, I mean, it worked out great for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So the person that shows up in the police car, is that actual police officer?
Yep, sure is. Oh. Yep, the same guy that's actually at the house when they're unloading the body. Travis Trainer is his name, and he was the actual police officer that shows back up and gets pulled out of the vehicle. And that was actually two different shots as well. That was basically the dash cam was set up in my dad's pickup truck, and we filmed that whole scene my assistant director was driving, and I got out of the vehicle and helped shake the vehicle and put blood on the window, which will be in the special features of the Blu-ray. And then we set up a tripod camera and parked the actual police car into a garage area and had a table beside the car, and had him go through the motions and drug him out and onto a table. So, and then we layered him in the editor, faded out the opacity, kind of gave it a yellow tint to it, and then recreated all the sound effects you hear in that scene, and kind of made it look like it was actually the same scene all the way through, which it wasn't.
Yeah, this is stuff that, upon watching the film, we didn't even notice. Deft hand with the editing, man. That's awesome.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we, like I said, we kind of had ideas of what we wanted to do, but we weren't, we kind of knew how we were going to do them, but we weren't sure how it was going to turn out. And it worked out great. That's one thing I'm the most proud of with the film, is that no one can pick out like editing mistakes or, I could see this. Like one of my favorite, one of the movies that scared me as a kid was Puppet Master. And there's this scene in particular where the puppet's cutting up a guy. I think it's Puppet Master 2. Guy's cutting up the puppet's cutting up the guy on the bed, and the girl comes back into the room, and she's so shocked, she leans back and she knocks this lamp off the table. Well, if you go back and watch it now, you can actually see the assistant in this hand come up in the scene and catch that lamp. So someone who is, part of the film crew, is she knocks over the lamp, and all of a sudden here comes his hand up to catch that lamp so they don't break it for continuity.
There's got to be stuff like that in every movie. We just don't notice it.
Right, yeah. And that was one of our main things, is especially since it's a found footage film, you don't have like a big crew or anything behind you. So, you can eliminate that aspect of like having someone show up in the scene that's not supposed to be there. But, we try to alleviate all those mistakes the best we could. So the fact that no one's pointed any out to us yet, that just makes me feel that much more better about the product.
Is editing something you like, or was it more tedious for you?
It's kind of a love hate. I love being able to take all the different scenes that we shot and put them in the editor. It's just, the more technical stuff with this. I hate foliage work. I hate it. It's terrible. Me and foliage work, making sound effects, do not get along. And, we when we signed our distribution deal, because most found footage films, if a foreign market picks them up, they have foreign subtitles at the bottom, because, they don't go around and create an M&E track. Basically, what sounds you hear in the movie are on the camera, and you usually don't have actors come in and dub the voices or, redo their lines and stuff like that. So one of the requirements for our deal was an M&E track. So I basically had to go back before the movie came out. I had to go back and recreate every single sound effect for the entire 74-minute film. And it was a nightmare. It took us from February to July of 2017 to get that wrapped. And that was just like, oh my gosh. And the crazy part is the sound effects we recreated sound better than the sounds in the actual movie.
Yeah, sometimes that probably happens.
Yeah, he stepped on that, that tree branch or whatever. That definitely made a sound on the thing. So you spend, an hour trying to try to get the right sound for that tree branch snapping, and then you go back and look at the original cut, and you're like, you don't even hear it.
I don't know how deeply we want to delve into spoiler territory, because you do want more people to watch the movie, so we don't necessarily want to talk about the ending,
right?
But actually, I'm gonna just avoid that question altogether. I'm gonna pass it back to Richard then, because I was gonna straight up spoil it.
No spoilers.
This is how tired I am. I'm sorry, guys.
it's all right. So are these your friends? Like, you said that, were they all your friends basically?
Yeah, pretty much. Whenever Tyler and Gavin, who are kind of the main, douchebags in the movie, they've been my best friends for years. They actually both stood up with me at my wedding. A lot of people, I've been on podcasts before where the people are like, are these guys really that much of a jerk in real life. And I said, no, they just wanted to play that type of character. So I kind of wrote that character around, because when you hang around people, you know, mannerisms and different things they say and things like that. So you can just type that into their dialogue and just make them a little more douchey than what they would be in real life. And it just kind of gives it more of a natural flow to it. So, but Tyler also helped co-write the film with me. And then Andrea, I've known her for years. Griffin in the movie is actually Gavin's brother. A lot of people don't know that. And then Heidi was friends with Andrea. So that's kind of how like the main cast kind of came together. So, but yeah, we'd always talked about making a film, and, it got to the point to where no one was really taking the reins. So I'm like, you know what, let's just do it. So I came up with the concept, and, me and Tyler wrote the script around it, and we got our locations and started filming.
How long was the actual shoot process?
Oh, man. You mean just like total time? If you took all the days and put them together, or like how many? Because it took a few years for us to. We started filming in 2011 and finally showed it and wrapped in 2013. So, and actually, I take that back. I actually wasn't done filming until 2017, because one of the things for the distributor was those evidence placards we have in the film that tell you whose camera is whose. And that's one of my biggest pet peeves in the found footage film, that there's multiple cameras. Sometimes you get lost on whose camera you're actually looking at, or where's this other camera, because there's no one holding the camera. So we made sure we put these evidence placards to identify which camera's which. But apparently, since it was it had text on it, it has to fit within these certain guidelines, which we thought we were within all of them for the film. But apparently there's some specific guidelines for foreign markets. So I actually had to go back and recreate every one of those evidence placards and reshoot that. That was the final thing I did before we sent it to the distributor. I thought we were done filming. And then, I got the M&E track down. We're good to go. And then I get that back on the QC report saying, yeah, you got to redo the placards. And I'm like, oh.
What did you have to redo about it? I mean, were they different than what we saw?
Well, basically, the placards are what it is just like a little thing that you like place the letters on. So basically, what we would do is we would recreate the placard. For Jed. So we do Jed's, we record it. Okay, we got it. All right, now let's do Griffin's. We have to take all those little letters back off and respell it out again and do it again, and we just keep doing it. And because we finished shooting the placards in like 2013, I think. So, it was in a box, some of the letters came off. So I had to redo all those letters. So, and you have to make sure the spacing's right. And it's just, it was like,
Yeah, that sounds tedious. Yeah, putting them all back.
Yeah, you had to make sure everything was spelled right and just.
So, whose house was it?
There's a guy here in town named Roscoe who owned the house, and it's set vacant for years. Someone was renting it, but it's actually for sale now. So, if someone's interested in buying a house that was in unlisted owners for sale right now, but. Even when I was a kid, I was always fascinated with this house. I always had like a cool vibe to it, kind of creepy look. And I just remember that staircase as a kid. My dad took me there for some reason. There was someone living there at the time he needed to talk to. And I just remember seeing that staircase. And whenever we came up with the concept for Unlisted Owner, I'm like, it'd be cool if we could get that house. So just called him up and he let us shoot there. So it worked out great. And, it wasn't like anyone was living there. It was completely unfurnished. So it was perfect for a family just moving in. I mean, there was, we didn't have to worry about storing someone's furniture somewhere and stuff. It just worked out great. So, and then, as far as like the blood and stuff, we could just put down moving plastic down and you wouldn't get blood stains on the carpet and stuff like that. And it would just all look natural. Like, oh yeah, that's believable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great idea. I mean, it didn't look out of place at all. It really fit with the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people. The staircase is crazy. It's really cool.
Oh yeah, it's such a beautiful staircase. It has that statue at the bottom with the light on it, and the house is actually called they call it the Heinemann Mansion. Supposedly, it was a nursing home at one point in time. One of the craziest things about shooting this thing was whenever we announced that we had shot this film and we posted pictures of the house, we had people from all over messaging us stuff about my grandpa lived there, or my family used to own it at one point in time, because that house has changed hands for years and years and years. And it was just so cool to hear all these different stories about this house.
Yeah, that is really cool. Yeah, it's awesome that you could do all this on such a, you know, basically mostly free budget. I mean, yeah, you know, yeah, just using your resources, like you said.
Yeah, it worked out great. I mean, that house, you know, it's basically a 3-story house if you think about it. I mean, well, actually 4 if you count the basement. And the basement's the same size as the whole house. And then that whole top floor part is just one big wide open room that's pretty much the size of the whole house. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I got a little disoriented a couple of times because the house is so big and you don't really know the layout. And it's like, where is this? Like, there's like a room in a room, and like it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a very unique house. I mean, it was the perfect house for this movie for sure. I mean, it worked out great.
Now, found footage subgenre stuff is kind of, some people love it, some hate it. But it's been under kind of scrutiny for, well, since Blair Witch.
Right.
Yes. You know, really, like, not the first found footage movie, but probably
the first mainstream.
Oh yeah, first one to just like totally exploit the viral campaign and
right.
You know, that whole thing. Do you think if someone wants to become a filmmaker and they're particularly interested in horror, do you think found footage is the way to go for their first feature? Or do you, you know, knowing what you know now that you've done this?
I would say, basically, if you're going to make a movie, make sure you work within your means. You don't want to try to overdo something. I'm not a big fan of, like, you know, hokey CGI, or, you know, just work within your budget to try to make the best product you can. I know there's, like, you know, half probably the people in the U.S. don't like horror movies, and then even half of the fans of horror movies probably don't like found footage films. So found footage films are a harder sell. I mean, whenever I went out to the American film market, that was one of the biggest issues we had, was, you know, I'd pitch the movie to different distributors out there, and they would be like, you know, you had me until you said found footage, you know. So it is a hard sell, but there are, there is a huge fan base for found footage films. There's actually a site called foundfootagecritic.com that they basically try to inventory every found footage movie ever made, and they review it, and they have basically a database. And they actually have their own streaming platform. It's called POV Horror. Unlisted Owner is also available on POV Horror. Don't quote me on this. I think it's like $3.99 a month, I think. And they constantly have new found footage films. So if you're a big found footage fan, it's the perfect streaming channel for you, because they have constantly uploading new content on there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's cool to know. That's actually, I mean, I'm a fan of it mostly, even though I've never seen Blair Witch.
Really?
Oh, man. Yeah,
never seen it. It was just hyped, you know, back in the day, mm-hmm. and then I missed it in the theater, and then, you know, all my friends hated it, so then I was like, well, I'm just not going to watch it, so, and then I just never have.
I saw it in the theater when it first came out, and we were all still assuming that these people actually died.
Right, yeah.
And it was a huge deal at that time, but, you know, after a while, you see them show up on award shows and in commercials, you're like, okay. Yeah. Hell, one of those... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jed.
I was going to say, it's kind of sad. You're like, man, I wish you were dead, you know? like so disappointed to see him alive, you know?
One of the guys in it, I can't remember his name. He's in a movie that came out in 2018 called Unsane. That's Steven Soderbergh, a film that was shot on iPhones.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's the guy who played Josh or something, you know, because it's just three people. It's like two guys and a girl. And then, you know, the witch or whatever the hell. But, yeah, he's in that Unsane movie, which not a bad movie. It's kind of decent.
But, yeah, I mean, I think found footage, I mean, it does have its place in horror, even though it's kind of like, you know, the unwanted, you know, stepbrother of it. But, you know, it's still a genre that's still popular and carries a lot of weight. It's just, you know, and I think a lot of distributors like that I talk to, you know, they kind of aim more, not just for the U.S. and North American markets. You know, they're looking at a worldwide, and, you know, a lot of other countries still haven't caught on to the found footage style filmmaking quite yet. And making a found footage film is I mean, it's hard in so many ways, and compared to actually making a traditionally shot thing. I mean, I haven't made a completely traditionally shot feature film, but I mean, when you're doing a found footage, you know, you got a very limited crew. You know, you don't have all these eyes also watching that you can go to. You know, you're basically looking through a viewfinder of a camera. If you want to do an effects driven scene, like say if you have someone jumping through a window in a traditionally shot film, you can have like probably you can have like four or five or even you can have 100 different camera angles, you know, of this person going through a window. But when you shoot a found footage film, you have to make sure that you get that angle exactly right, and it has to be believable or people are going to completely not be immersed in your movie and just completely pulling out. So, I mean, there's a lot of challenging factors that play into found footage films.
Yeah. Not, I mean, what do you think the reason is for people? I mean, cause you know, I love horror movies. It's my main genre. I love talking to people about them, but I talked to a lot of people about found footage. And like the second I mention that they get completely turned off. You think it's just because there's so much of it, or what?
I think it has. I mean, the market has been oversaturated. I mean, anybody can make a found footage film. I mean, you can make a found footage short. I mean, you could take your camera phone, act like you hear something down a hallway, go down there, and then, you know, get a jump scare. I mean, it's, you know, it's really easy for someone to create, and I think that's what kind of takes it away or rubs, you know, especially horror fans the wrong way, because they feel like, oh, great, it's another, you know, one just, you know, stupid movie of people walking around with a camera. It's shaky. The most comments I hear is, oh, it's a shaky camera type movie. But, you know, in a way, I think found footage is kind of, I mean, in some ways it is more scary than a traditional monster movie, because, you know, a lot of found footage films like Unlisted Owner, for instance, I mean, it deals with real life horror. I mean, it's real life. I mean, it's in your face. It's not like supernatural elements or stuff like that. I mean, some of the found footage films is like, you know, it's like, is this real? I mean, what am I watching is reality based. And as popular as reality TV is, I'm really shocked that found footage hasn't really found that of, you know, real popular niche, like, you know, reality shows have.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about that too. And like what, Ghost Hunters, that kind of stuff, you know, there's a lot of found footage movies that are on that same exact topic.
Grave Encounters is one of my top found footage films. I love the first Grave Encounters, and, you know, it's based, I don't know if you guys have seen it or not, but if not, I highly recommend it. But I mean, it's a found footage movie about ghost hunters that go to an asylum. I mean, it's, you know, it definitely has its place in horror, whether people want to admit it or not. But I don't know. I don't know if it'll ever like become as, you know, popular as what, you know, it is, you know, like slasher or, you know, sci-fi horror or any of those other genres.
Yeah, that I don't remember much about it because it's been so long since I've seen it. But I do remember liking it. I mean, and there's been some really solid found footage stuff, you know, not too long ago, like the Creep and Creep 2.
Yep. Yep.
The Mark Duplass.
Yep, those are both great films. Yeah, that is a definitely. I mean, it's reality based horror, and you know, I really do think that people, you know, since there are so many different found footage movies, and it is easy for people to make, I think that's, you know, the main reason it gets such a bad rap. And, you know, and Blair Witch did got a lot of heat when it came out too. I mean, especially after people found out it wasn't real, then that just kind of, I think that really turned a lot of people off.
Yeah, I think, and the problem I think with Blair Witch is that it's, you know, they build up and they build up and they build up and really like nothing happens. You know, there's just like a long period in that movie where nothing happens. And the payoff is, you know, I'm not going to spoil it or anything for Richard, but, you know, it's just not, there's not a lot going on. You know,
right. I do feel at that time, you know, it was something unique and, you know, people had never seen before and stuff. But, you know, I mean, it is, you know, it is dated for sure. But I mean, it did revolutionize an entire genre. I mean, that's the one thing it did, you know, do right. But at the same time, it did kind of turn a lot of people off to the genre at the same time. It's kind of like a double-edged sword.
Yeah, Wreck and Quarantine are two of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
I even like Quarantine 2. I know a lot of people didn't, but I was really hoping that would spark that franchise back. But I'm not sure the second one, I can't remember if it was found footage. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie, but the Wreck series is great.
Oh yeah, yeah. Those are also great. I mean, whenever you, especially if you're going to try to make a found footage film, you know, that's one thing you do is kind of watch, you know, found footage films and how they're made, and just kind of, you know, watch the different camera angles and stuff, and just see how they do stuff. I mean, whenever we shot Unlisted Owner, we shot the scenes inside the house. I actually had a digital transmitter on my camera, and depending on which floor we were shooting on, we had a TV set up, and it didn't transfer audio, just video, but we would constantly be moving that TV from room to room. So my assistant director could go in there and watch what I was filming to make sure, you know, that I'd come to him after I'd get done with a scene, and I would say, "Hey, Brent, what do you think of this?" And he'd say, "Well, everything looked great, but why don't you try focusing more on the symbol on the wall, or, you know, your camera kind of went really out of focus right there." Because whenever you're acting and also trying to film something, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, it's one thing to be able to, you know, like Mel Brooks, you know, you're directing something and then you're constantly going back and forth. But, you know, when a found footage film, you know, you're trying to look through the viewfinder and, you know, concentrate on your acting. You don't have someone else to take care of the actual filming part. You're doing, you know, both. So sometimes it's, you know, it's better to have a second set of eyes to check it out, but you can't do that all the time. So, I mean, that's another major challenge with it.
You mentioned the symbol on the wall, and I was actually going to ask you about that. Sort of at the end of the movie or in that last 20 minutes or so, they do find a symbol on the inside of the house. Did you have any backstory for that? I mean, you never really go into it in the film, but did you have an idea of what that backstory might have been?
Well, that's something that if Unlisted Owner 2 ever happens, that would be something that we would kind of talk about in that film. Exactly. So cool. It's something I don't want to really spoil. I mean, there's a, you know, I'm hoping there'll be a chance for Unlisted Owner 2 to come out. But, you know, like I said, we're kind of saving some stuff for that. But I mean, I would love to tell you, but
no, absolutely. Then you'd have to kill me.
Yeah. I might know a guy, you know, the
owner. I got you. No, it's very cool. I mean, that part of it did kind of add some depth to what was going on of, you know, I was curious of, you know, what was kind of happening.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and the major turning point of that whole film is whenever the police call, whenever they call in the break-in, whenever that happens, you can just tell that's when the whole mood of the story just completely changes, where, you know, they were, you know, just acting like idiots. And now, you know, it's getting kind of crazy because now they're getting ready to break into this house. And whenever that cop leaves, that's whenever you're like, oh, this isn't good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just saying, I would have busted the window and gotten out of there. He kept telling her no. And I was like, yeah, I would just do it.
Suspension of disbelief is absolutely necessary for horror movies.
Oh, yeah, I know. We're watching this new TV show called The Passage on Fox, me and my wife. And it's a great show. We love it. But man, you have to suspend a lot of belief.
Yeah, and that also, I was going to mention this earlier, but one thing you may notice in the film, there's a lot of language in it. There's a lot of F-bombs in the film. We actually had submitted it to the Guinness Book of World Records for most F-words in a horror film, but they rejected it, saying that it wasn't in their guidelines for a sub-genre, because they have most F-words in a movie, period. And then, so I tried to go for a horror film. All the research I did, the only thing I could find was Devil's Rejects, and it was like 224 F-bombs, and we had 245. So,
jeez, man.
But like I said, I was really hoping that we would get the record, but they basically said that, like, they actually don't judge that type of stuff. The reason they give those records out is because, you know, like, experts in that field say that that is a record. And, you know, since this is and they also don't do subgenres, I guess. So, but yeah, I mean, I haven't heard anybody tell me that they, you know, a horror film has more than ours. So I'm still waiting to hear. But so if anybody knows, you know, hit me up on Twitter at Mr. Jed Bryan and let me know if there's a movie that beats 245.
I'm going to start counting.
There you go.
There's got to be some horror nerd out there just keeping up with spreadsheets and facts and figures. There's got to be.
Fingers crossed. But yeah, it's I think by ear it's 245 with closed captioning. I think it's like 230 something, but that still beats Devil's Rejects. So
closed captioning brings up some funky stuff.
Oh yeah,
it's my favorite sometimes.
Yeah. Especially watch on wrestling. Prime.
Yeah, watch wrestling with closed caption. It is hilarious. They talk so fast, I guess, that they keep up and they just start making stuff up. Like, it's great.
Yeah, that was one of the fun things. Like, for our distribution deal, we had to get closed captioning for it. So I went through an outfit, which I can't remember the name of them, but I mean, they were relatively cheap and they got it done like within 24 hours. I was really shocked. And, you know, you have to go back through and, you know, see what errors there are. And I was like, some of them, I was like, that's not, you know, this person didn't say this, you know? So it's like, you know, it says Andrea said this. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm the one that said that.
I did notice that, but I didn't think about it enough to count it. You know what I mean? Just so at this point, it's just like I hear that in movies so much that it's like it doesn't really, you know, I don't say that around my kids, but you know, when I'm watching a horror movie, my kids aren't around either. So I just don't even think about the how frequently it happens.
Right. Well, in Unlisted Owner specifically, you know, we wanted to portray rotten kids, rotten millennials that, you know, are just, you know, out to have fun and party and just, you know, they don't care. So, you know, and I mean, a lot of kids, younger people talk like this, say it, you know, maybe, I don't know if they say as much as we did in the movie, but I mean, some of them say it pretty close, I'm pretty sure. So, but we wanted to kind of add that a little bit of believability to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if we've covered this or not, but what's, you talked about making a sequel to it, to Unlisted Owner. What's the roadblock? Just funding or?
Of that. And also, well, like I said, you know, Unlisted Owner, we're still trying to make enough off of it to be able to cover cost and be able to, you know, buy equipment, proper equipment and stuff. Like I said, we're kind of in the middle of nowhere, so it's really hard to rent stuff where we're at. So, you know, just try to be able to raise enough money to be able to get equipment and stuff. And also, I mean, I would like to try my hand at a traditionally shot film, feature length. I mean, that's what I, you know, started out making, traditionally shot stuff. But it's, you know, I'd kind of like to go that route because, I mean, you know, I love found footage, but I don't want to be known as, you know, a found footage guy only. You know, I'd like to, you know, a lot of my other scripts are, you know, traditionally shot. It's just I didn't have the funding to make those, like Meth House. I mean, I would love to have made Meth House, but, you know, I didn't have the funding to make that. So I had to basically write Unlisted Owner around the resources I had at hand. So that's the reason we kind of went that route.
Well, you know, they say circumstances can make things, you know, like trials and tribulations can make things better, you know, if you have to struggle through it, that like hunger tends to make you work harder, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, yeah. And I mean, and Unlisted Owner, you know, it really did, you know, I knew I could make a film, but I wasn't sure exactly how I was going to get it done. And now, you know, after you get the first one off your chest, you really, I mean, you learn so much and you make so many connections. I mean, once you cross that threshold into I'm now an indie filmmaker, I mean, you make so many connections, meet so many cool so many cool filmmakers and actors. And, you know, you make so many connections. It just opens up all these doors. So, I mean, I'm so grateful that we were able to make the film. And it just, I mean, it really did prove that, you know, yeah, I can make a film. I just, you know, if I get the right funding and stuff, I can make a traditionally shot film of one of my other scripts. So
you could go, sorry, Corey.
No, it's okay. Go ahead, Richard.
I was going to say you could go the route of, what was it? I think Rec 3, it wasn't found footage, was it? You could just make Unlisted Owner a traditionally shot movie.
Yeah, I mean, you could. Yeah, that one always kind of threw me for a loop because it was all found footage and all of a sudden I was like, wait a second.
Yeah, and then the fourth one goes back to found footage.
Yeah, yeah. It's
what about getting together with other indie filmmakers and kind of making like a anthology, something like that, you know, something like a VHS or –
I know there's a filmmaker. It's about probably 2 hours from me. He his name's PJ Starks, and he does the Volumes of Blood franchise. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah, I've seen those. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So he lives kind of close, and that was one I had no clue. I didn't know that he was even around here. I'd actually never heard of his stuff until he added me on Facebook, and I was doing a DVD in store signing at Barnes and Noble in Evansville, Indiana, and he had hit me up and stuff. And yeah, I was really sad to see he was trying to get funding, or he still is trying to get funding for Volumes of Blood 3. He tried to do a crowdfunding campaign and it didn't really work out like he had hoped. And but I think he's trying to get the funding in other ways. But yeah, I mean, there are people that do the anthologies and stuff like that. And I have thought about it, but I don't, for like in my head, I mean, the scripts I have written so far, they're all just, you know, like one story, one, you know, through and through. So I think I'm not exactly sure how most people do anthologies, if they bring in several different filmmakers and writers and stuff, and they write different pieces to a story, like they have a general outline and do it. I'm not exactly sure how they go about doing it. I think to me it'd be a little kind of like challenging to make a whole bunch of shorts and then try to structure it together as one thing by yourself.
Yeah, I just think those are so fun though. Like,
oh yeah, they are. Yeah, I mean, I love his, I love Volumes of Blood. I mean, I think once I found out about him, I bought his Blu-ray and, you know, checked it out, and checked out the second one too. And I was just, you know, it was really cool to see the different styles of shooting and different stuff that he's done.
Yeah, it'd be cool to see different styles come together too. Like,
oh yeah,
like that's one thing I just. Like, you know, like Creep Show and Trick or Treat.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And
yep.
Even, I mean, have you guys seen ABCs of Death?
I love the first one.
I have not seen this. I'll have to make a note of this.
The first one, I think, is really good.
ABCs of Death.
26 yeah, short films. Like, each one is a different letter of the alphabet.
Really?
Yeah. That's interesting. They're 5 minutes or less, I think.
Huh?
Yeah, they're some of them are very short.
They have to be for that.
Yeah, because the whole thing's only like what, 2 hours?
Just over two, probably.
So yeah, it's and some of them, you know, the first time I saw it, some of them were really, really out there. Like I didn't love them, but the concept I love. But
right, oh yeah,
26 really different, you know, different shorts. Points of view.
That's impressive. That is a great storyline. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And I mean, some pretty famous people too. I mean, I think Soska Sisters, I think they did one, and
Adam Wingard and Ty West.
Yeah. Ty West. Oh yeah. Ty West's one was as controversial as Ty West is.
There was one. This was probably the worst one on the first movie. It was about these guys sitting in these chairs and they're like strapped down and they have to masturbate and they have to one gets off first lives and they kill the other one, and like they just do this awful stuff. They like bring out kids at one point and like all kinds of horrible shit.
And I think there's an animated one, like a claymation one. So there's different, all different styles. I think when it was out, because it was back in 2012, I think, or so. And
that sounds right.
When it was out, they basically just gave the people the letter, and that was it. They let them do whatever they wanted.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, they didn't hinder them or anything.
But yeah, I'm interested to see what you come up with next.
Well, thanks.
And you know,
yeah, we like I said, I have that script for Meth House that's about killer meth heads that terrorize a community. I really like to do that one. And actually, I just acted in a film. I think it was in October. They just end up wrapped shooting here last week. It's called Trick and Treats.
And it was actually shot in Mount Zion, Illinois, central Illinois, and actually has Malcolm McDowell. He voices a talking jack-o'-lantern in it. So I'm hoping, I'm not exactly sure when that's going to come out. I think they were hoping it's going to come out this October, but I know how that can be sometimes with things being delayed and stuff, especially depending on what kind of distributor they get. But I'm looking forward to that one to be, you know, in the same film as Malcolm McDowell, of all people.
Yeah, that's wild, man.
Yeah, it's called Trick and Treats. They have a Facebook page. I think they're on Twitter and Instagram, I believe, too. I think the name of the studio is Heroic Age Studios. They have a Facebook page as well, and they have updates on there and stuff. They have some behind-the-scenes pictures of the shoots that they've done. But, yeah, I was lucky enough to get a small role in that film. So that was the last thing I've done here recently.
Your traditional movie, would it also be horror, or would you go another route?
Most of my scripts are horror. I have a couple of suspense thrillers that I would like to do, and then I have one comedy that I haven't outlined. I haven't quite put the whole script down in pen and paper yet. But I mean, I love horror movies. Ever since I was a kid, my parents used to take me and my brother to haunted houses. I mean, we always decorated big for Halloween, and I had the VHS of House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price, and watched Scooby-Doo and, you know, King Kong versus Godzilla. So I've always been a horror fan my whole life. And then when I saw Eli Roth's Hostel, that's when everything just kind of like real life horror, like really set in. It's like, wow, I can write. I have so many fears in my life, things that scare me, and I could just put those fears into a script form and see. I mean, Unless Donor is basically based on my fear of peer pressure and being in a situation with a group of friends where it's like, do you bail on your friends or do you try to go help them out? And then if you get in that situation where, well, you know, you really can't help them out, like how do you get out without yourself getting in trouble? So that was kind of the basis behind the principle of Unlisted Owner, is the fear of, you know, peer pressure and getting in situations where it's like, because everybody's been there where you're around a group of people and you're like, they're doing something. You're like, I shouldn't be here, but I don't know how to get out without making myself look like an idiot to these people that I care so highly about their opinions, which I shouldn't.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like the whole like some people watch Unlisted Owner and they just see a bunch of kids being stupid and, you know, break into a house. But to me, you know, the whole, you know, underneath all the layers, it's basically a story about, you know, peer pressure and friends. And, you know, because you got two people that are just ragging on these two guys who used to be, you know, they were pretty like basically the script's written as Tyler and Gavin were, and Griffin and Jed were like best of friends, you know, bros before hoes, all that stuff. And then Griffin and Jed get settled down with these girls, and then it turns Gavin and Tyler into these big douches, basically trying to pressure Andrea and Heidi to break up with us and basically pretty much make us choose either the girls or our friends. And that's basically what Unlisted Owner is all about. Like, I think people sometimes get the wrong idea that they think Tyler and Gavin have been like jerks to us like our whole lives. But it's basically to the point to where, you know, these girls are dragging down the fun times that we used to have. And now they're going to peer pressure us and just basically keep up in the ante of, you know, first, you know, they're drinking and driving, they're going to a cemetery after dark, and now they're breaking into a crime scene. So each part of the night, it just keeps getting taken to a new level of peer pressure to kind of make you feel like, okay, you know, it's going to be, you know, us or them. You know, you're going to have to make a choice at one point in time.
Actually, something you said made a lot of sense to me, like you know, dealing with your own personal fears and stuff like that, putting that into your art, because you know, I've been dealing with like anxiety and depression for a while, and like one of the things I started doing was actually writing these stories about the stuff that scares me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I love horror, so one of my New Year's resolutions for this year was to actually finish like a short, like, I mean, it'd be very short, screenplay, and then actually shoot it. of, you know, these stories that are things that actually bother me. And it may not bother anybody else, but just getting, I think, getting that out there is kind of therapeutic.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there, just because people that, you know, you're that are in your life are not scared of these things. I guarantee you there's people out there that are, or people out there that had no clue that this is even a fear. And they're like, oh, my gosh, this scares the heck out of me. I mean, you know, meth house. I mean, the methamphetamine problem in our area is a huge issue. And I mean, it's creepy to me if I go into a convenience store and there's someone in there tweaking out, and you're just like, you know, what are they going to do? I mean, I have police officer friends that said, you know, sometimes it takes three or four of them just to take down one person that's strung out of their mind. So, you know, I kind of wrote that concept into Meth House. And I mean, there's like, you know, every story I have is like, you know, every script I have is like a fear of mine of like, you know, if I got put in this situation, what would I do? And then basically I 20 question it to death of, okay, what are the different scenarios that could happen? And then kind of write a story around that.
Yeah, man, I dig that. I think that's a cool way to come up with an idea. If it scares you, it's going to, like you said, it's going to scare somebody else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's
even if not, hell, you got it out there, right? Like,
right.
You know,
well, I mean, we're all human. I mean, there's, you know, we're all connected in a certain way. And, you know, and fear is a major way people, you know, are connected. And, you know, I'm not scared of snakes, but I know at least probably 10 people that are scared of snakes. I mean, you know, everybody has at least, you know, if you have a fear, I guarantee you someone else in the world has that fear. If not, you know, hundreds of thousands of them.
Yeah, I don't like snakes, man.
See, there we go. There we go.
Indiana Jones don't like them.
Yeah, Indiana Jones don't even like them. So, I mean, you know, it's, you know, to each their own. But, you know, if you have that fear, I mean, who can write a movie about something scary? Then, you know, who can do it better than someone who actually has that fear in their mind and can think of all the horrible, scary scenarios to be able to put that into a script form?
Yeah. Yeah, dude. And my just, you know, a little inside baseball here. My first session with my therapist, he talks about I have a talent. This is a talent, apparently, or a skill for catastrophic worry. So, you know, I hear about somebody getting a divorce or someone's kid getting sick, and like instantly within seconds my mind goes to the absolute worst case scenario and all these things. So when I think about those things, it freaks me out, you know, it sends me into like a tailspin. So when I started kind of pinpointing what was causing the worries, I thought, well, hell, this is not a bad story, you know.
Right.
So I told him, I started pinning it down in a book, and he thought that was a really good idea. So
may have, you know, if you thumb back through your book, I mean, you may have like an idea and there's some, you know, script that you could create that would, you know, pull the doors off of anything out there.
Maybe. I don't know about that. I would be happy at least to put it out in like a tangible form would be kind of neat, you know.
Yeah, and that's probably the coolest thing, you know, about Unlisted Owner. I mean, it was something that I thought up a concept in my head, and me and my buddy actually wrote the script for. And being able to take, like, there's a big difference between like writing a book and you know, making a movie. I mean, I've never written a book before, but I had an English teacher that told me that she hated the movie Jurassic Park. And I didn't understand why. And she's told me that she had read the book Jurassic Park, and that the dinosaurs that she had envisioned in her mind were not the dinosaurs that she saw on the screen. And that's why she hated it. And it really spoke to me, because it was like, you know, whenever you make a movie, you know, you're showing the audience what your vision is. And, you know, what's more artistic than that? Whereas if you write a book, I mean, people are able to imagine whatever they want. So, you know, that's why I kind of like the filmmaking more than, you know, the writing. I mean, I love the writing because I had the ideas in my head. But whenever you actually get it, you know, actually made, and someone actually takes the time and watches it, it's like, it's so cool to me to think that, you know, something that was in my head is now viewable for people all over the world. People all over the world can see Sumner, Illinois, my hometown. So it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's filmmaking. It's your vision, you know, all the way through. Whereas, you know, people can interpret a book. I mean, I guess you can interpret a movie different ways too. But you know, what you're seeing is what.
It's right there.
Yep. They intended to put that on film.
Yep.
Or probably not even film these days. But
yeah, yeah. Ours was all SD cards. So.
That's nice though, because you can edit it so much easier.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. It was great. You know, I mean, your dailies were basically, you just pop the SD card out of your camera, stick it in your computer and copy and paste and watch.
That's excellent. Well, Richard, do you have any other questions, man?
No, I think I covered everything I wanted to talk with Jed about. Yeah, I think I'm good.
Jed, do you have anything, any other points you wanted to bring up?
I just wanted to, well, first off, I want to thank you both for taking the time to watch Unlisted Owner. I'm very grateful that you guys took the time to watch it. If you wouldn't mind rating it, anybody out there who's seen the film, rate it on IMDb or whatever platform you buy or rent it from, because that's what gets people to watch these films. So I would appreciate anybody out there listening to do that. If you haven't seen Unlisted Owner, it is available on DVD through Amazon, Walmart, FYE, Barnes & Noble, and I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other places you can get it on DVD too if you just Google it. If you like streaming, it's free on Amazon Prime, or you can rent or buy it on Amazon. You can also get it through on POV Horror if you have the streaming channel POV Horror, Google Play Store, iTunes. And I'm sure I'm forgetting some other streaming platforms it's available on. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at Unlisted Owner. You can follow us on Facebook. Just type in Unlisted Owner on Facebook. If you can like our page, we'll have updates about the upcoming Blu-ray. Not exactly sure what all platforms it's going to be on, but I know that it'll have the special features of the commentary on there, plus 20 minutes behind the scenes that are different than the 10 minutes behind the scenes that are actually on the DVD. If you want to follow me personally, you can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Jed Bryan. If you can follow me on Instagram also at Mr. Jed _ Bryan.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, Jed.
No problem. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, dude. It's hard to keep me awake at these hours, and you did it, man.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad I could be entertaining.
All right, guys, go check out the Unlisted Owner. You know, give Jed some feedback, and hopefully he can get the follow up here. You know,
we want that sequel.
The near future. The near future.
There we go.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us here on Vitamin Geek, and we'll see you again here in a couple weeks with new episodes.
Yes, yes, hello. Let's talk about the Flopcast.
Every week, we give podcast listeners a chance to come and join us in Chickentown,
where we talk about Saturday morning cartoons, comics and science fiction conventions, music and concert reports, 70s and 80s pop culture, and for no good reason, chickens.
Boy, we're weird.
Oh, we are ridiculous.
We're proud members of the ESO Network, and you can find us at flopcast.net.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.